This free program is paid for by the listeners of WBAI New York. If you're not already a member, think about joining us to help keep free speech alive.
The Tri-State Area and streaming live throughout planet Earth on WBAI.org.
Well, it is, I presume, midnight in New York City, and you are tuned to listener-supported non-commercial WBAI 99.5 FM. Although, strictly speaking, I'm not sure of that because I'm not really here right now. But, assuming that I'm correct, that means that it's time for this. Moorish. Orthodox. Radio. Crusade. Anarchism for the global city. Radical environmentalism for the concrete jungle. Esoteric explorations of the secret history of rebel culture. The Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade. Every Tuesday at midnight after the news, only on listener-supported, non-commercial WBAI 99.5 FM in New York City. Be there.
Napoleon's a pastry, Bismarck is a herring, Alexander's a cream de coco mixed with rum, and Herbie Hoover is a vacuum. Columbus is a circle and a day off. Pershing is a square, what a payoff. Julius Caesar is just a salad on a shell. So, little brother, get wise to yourself. Life's a bowl and it's full of cherry pits. Play it big and it throws you for a loop. That's the way with fate. Comes today we're great. Comes tomorrow we're tomato soup. Napoleon's a pastry. Get this under your brow. What once used to be a rooster is just a duster now. Napoleon's a pastry. Dubarry is a lipstick. Pompadour's a hairdo. Good Queen Mary just floats along from peer to peer. Venus de Milo is a pink brassiere. The Gladstone is a bag, it is shocking. And the mighty Kaiser, just a stocking. The Tsar of Russia is now a jar of caviar. And Cleopatra is a black cigar. Yes, my honey lamb, Swift is just a ham. Lincoln's a tunnel, Coolidge is a dam. Yes, my noble lads, comes today with fads. Comes tomorrow we all subway ads. Homer is just a swat. Get this under your brow. All these big wig controversials are just commercials now. Better get your jug of wine and loaf of love before that final vow. Napoleon's a pastry, Caesar is a salad. Get it while you able.
All right, opening up with Lena Horne on this special pre-recorded episode of the Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade on listener-supported non-commercial WBAI 99.5 FM in New York City with me, Bill Weinberg. And the name of that song was Napoleon. It was from a musical, I don't know, from sometime in the 1950s, probably, entitled Jamaica. Very funny song, obviously, and one I play when I want to rant about the decline of the English language, and in particular that song obviously is riffing off of the English language's colonization by Madison Avenue, which is a part of the general juxtaposition of forces which are leading to the decline of, I would argue, the decline, the radical decline of the English language, which you know, you talk about this kind of thing and you immediately sound like you're just some, you know, stuffy English major, which I am not, by the way, who is, you know, bemoaning the rise of the vernacular and the abandoning of formalistic prose. And that's not at all what I'm getting at, because the decline of the English language ultimately, it means something far more sinister than that. It ultimately means the decline of thought and clarity, and rendering us much more vulnerable to political manipulation and commercial manipulation, and being putty in the hand of Madison Avenue, or government propagandists, or whoever else would hope to shape our consciousness and thereby our behavior. Now, what put this bug in my ear? Well, it's a bug which has been in my ear for a long time, but what put this bee in my bonnet tonight in particular is the fact that, well, I'm not really here right now from your perspective. Of course, from my perspective, I really am here right now. But from your perspective, hearing the sound of my voice, it's actually at least a week later than it is from my perspective in relative terms. Maybe more than a week later. I don't know when this is going to be broadcast during my absence, but presumably, as you are hearing the sound of my voice, I am actually on assignment in Peru. My first real journalistic assignment abroad in several years, something which I'm happy about. So, yeah, I'm in Peru at the moment. I mean, from your perspective, not from my perspective. From my perspective, I'm here in the studio in front of the microphone, and I'll be leaving for Peru in a week. But from your perspective, I'm already in Peru, you dear listener. And, you know, I'm not going down there to blog. I'm not going down there to vlog. Video blog? Vlog? Have you heard that one? I'm not going down there as a part of a, as a part of a solidarity delegation to be a prog. I'm not going down there to engage in psychedelic tourism and lick a frog. I'm not going down there to sit on the beach and drink grog. I'm going down there to do journalism. And I can't tell you what a breath of fresh air it is to be able to say that. Now, I don't mean to cast aspersion on bloggers, being a blogger myself, or on vloggers, or on progressives who are go down to Latin America as parts of solidarity delegations, nor even psychedelic tourists or, you know, who go down there to lick frogs or, you know, beach bums who go down there to drink grog. Those are all fine and legitimate things to do in their own right. But the thing is that lots of other people are doing them. And not too many people are doing journalism these days. Journalism is deeply in crisis. And this is tied to the larger crisis of the English language, which is what I'm going to be ranting about tonight. I'm going to be gone for 6 weeks. So sometime over the course of this period, presumably, this rant will be broadcast so that Anne-Marie Hendrickson, our once and future co-host on the Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade, can choose to take a night off during the 6 weeks that I am away, if she chooses to do so. So that's what I'm going to be ranting about the decline of journalism and the greater and related proposition of the decline of the English language in general. And when I talk about the decline of journalism, there is the general decline of journalism, which has to do with many factors, including the general crisis of media and newspapers, which is related to the economic downturn and also related to the ascendancy of the internet and the decline of print media. More particularly than the general decline of journalism, which is an alarming tendency in its own right, there is the decline of left-wing journalism, or as we used to call it, advocacy journalism. It's practically an extinct form. It really is. And, you know, this is a form which I've dedicated my life to, for better or worse. So it really hits me where it hurts. 10 years ago, 15 years ago, there really was a market for advocacy journalism. And by this I mean, you know, journalism which has got a POV and is trying to provide an alternative to, you know, mainstream or corporate media reportage, but is also actually journalism. That is to say, you know, it covers all the bases in terms of who, what, when, where, why, and is concerned with reporting facts as opposed to soapbox speechifying. Now, this is practically extinct. Almost all of the, magazines, but really more to the point, websites, which exist today on the left, are actually not producing journalism. They're producing polemicism. We're drowning in essays. Everything which is produced on, you know, I mean, let's name the big ones, right? Alternet, Huffington Post, The Nation, etc. Almost all of it is, you know, somebody's getting up there and getting on a soapbox and making a speech and engaging in a polemic. It's not about actually reporting the facts and letting the facts speak for themselves. And there's a few problems with this. One is that there's this implicit assumption that when you're engaging in polemicism actually doing an opinion piece, then you can be less than rigorous where facts and accuracy are concerned. Now, there is, polemicism is a legitimate form in its own right, but there's good polemicism and there's bad polemicism. And, okay, by way of good polemicism, you know, the master of the art is really, you know, I mean, Noam Chomsky really is. I mean, you can disagree with some of what he says, and God knows, in fact, I do disagree with much of what he says. But he does marshal or he has, I mean, not so much lately because, you know, he's kind of getting on in his years, but in, you know, his classic works, over the bulk of his career, he has, you know, marshaled an astounding, number of rigorously documented facts in defense of his every point. Which is, you know, that's good polemicism, right? Everything is documented, everything is footnoted, and every point which you're making is voluminously, you know, backed up with actual information. But too much of what is passing for left journalism these days is bad polemicism. Now, not all of it. There's still much good stuff which is being produced, but I will submit not as much as a decade ago, even though there's more being produced today because of the proliferation of websites and this whole DIY ethic, which in some ways is good, but there's a downside to it. And the downside is that, you know, very often there isn't any quality control. And even when there is quality control, you know, there actually is a certain degree of editorial oversight, the standards are really radically declining. And rather than, you know, marshaling a bunch of facts to make the point, there's more and more of an emphasis on attitude and smarmy put-downs and all of that sort of thing, which I suppose can be okay, but not when it's at the expense of rigor, okay? Sorry to be old-fashioned, but I feel pretty strongly about this. So this is, you know, in a there's two like converging areas where I feel very, very passionate about, where I'm really going to be, you know, focusing my energy while I'm in Peru. And one is, of course, what I'm going to be reporting on, which is the indigenous struggle, particularly that in the Amazon rainforest, of the indigenous peoples to protect their land from the oil companies and the erosion of their territorial rights by presidential decree of Alan Garcia in preparation for the free trade agreement with the United States. Kind of a replay of what happened in Mexico in the immediate prelude of the Zapatista revolt 15 years ago. So, very interesting. But the second thing, which I feel equally passionate about, is defending the form of journalism and to actually, you know, produce some real rigorous journalism as opposed to just going down there and, again, not to cast aspersions here, okay, because, I mean, I do plenty of blogging, God knows, but not just to go down there and blog, not just to go down there and, you know, be a prog, but to actually go down there and do a reportage. And, you know, I mean, I've been relegated, I feel, you know, it's kind of like the Borg, resistance is futile. I've been, by the contraction of the market for actual left journalism, I've been relegated to blogging more and more. But even the blogging that I do on my website, worldwar4report.com, I hesitate to call it blogging, actually, because it's really more of a news digest than it is a blog, all right? It's not just about smarmy put-downs, although I do occasionally engage in smarmy put-downs. And it's not just about attitude, although there is occasionally some attitude, but it's about repertorial rigor. And even when I'm relying on secondary sources, which is what I mean by blogging, really, or news digest, you know, it's all, you know, fastidiously documented, and it's all sort of digested and chewed on. It's more of a news digest than a blog, strictly speaking. You know, I'm going to be putting all of my energy when I'm in Peru. I mean, I'm going to do a certain amount of blogging, I suppose, but I'm going to be doing real journalism, trying to, resist its decline through my example. I will state, at risk of sounding hopelessly self-important and pompous, okay, forgive me. I am under assignment for two publications. I'm under assignment for NACLA Report on the Americas, That's North American Congress on Latin America, report on the Americas, and Indian Country Today. Also, of course, there'll be plenty of my updates on my own website, World War IV Report. I should state that, unfortunately, and this brings me back to the subject of my rant, NACLA report on the Americas is apparently in pretty deep financial crisis. I hope it's going to pull through. I hope it's going to weather the storm, just like WBAI is in pretty deep financial crisis. And we may have more to say on WBAI later. But, you know, all media is in financial crisis. And, of course, it's the alternative media which is being hit the hardest. And this, you know, relates to the more general phenomenon. I will state that for much of the last year, I was working on a freelance basis at a particular financial publication as a copy editor. And in a sign of the times, I was laid off. And they simply decided to, over the course of the time that I was working there, not going to mention the name of the publication, they went from four full-time copy editors with me pinch hitting on a freelance basis in case somebody called in sick to two full-time copy editors with me not pinch hitting in case somebody called in sick. And this is very, very symptomatic of what's going on in the industry generally. And this is across journalism. This is not just alternative journalism. This is across journalism. I mean, just read any newspaper, read any wire copy. You're going to start finding more and more and more typographical errors, grammatical errors, plain old factual errors, because nobody's fact-checking, because that's a part of a copy editor's job, is to fact-check, because they're laying off copy editors. They're just deciding to do without. So, and this is not, as I say, just affecting alternative media. This is affecting the mainstream, you know, newspapers and wire services. Very dangerous tendency. Very dangerous tendency. It's a part of a greater, ultimately, it's a symptom and a part of a greater and more dangerous tendency, which is the actual, I would say, you know, the not only the decline of the English language, but perhaps we're actually looking at the beginning of the transformation of the English language into something else, akin to Orwell's Newspeak from 1984, or perhaps even beyond that. Perhaps it goes even beyond that, and beyond merely the transformation of the English language into a new language, a degraded language, but the transformation of language, period, of human language into something else, which is degraded and less useful to communication, and particularly communication of specific information. So I am actually viewing in terms of, I think there's a few interrelated tendencies here, okay, which have to do with, all right, first of all, I'll make 4 points. Okay, the first is the one which I just elaborated on, which is the decline of journalism and standards of accuracy, which largely have to do with the hypertrophy of electronic media, of the internet, and the decline of print media. And secondarily, although also quite importantly, with the financial crisis and the general downsizing of the industry. This is the first tendency which we're looking at. Convergence of four factors. That's the first. Four interrelated factors. The second interrelated factor is that electronic media are actually changing the way that we use language, changing the way that we write, read, and communicate in a very, very intimate way. For instance, even note that, you know, the language is changing, right? There's this whole sort of new lingo which has emerged, the actual, you know, verbiage which we use to describe what we do when we communicate is changing, right? There's this whole new lingo which has emerged for that we use when we are texting as opposed to writing. All right, all of a sudden, you know, text has gone from being a noun to a verb. You know, we're texting, and there's all these like weird little shorthands that we use when we text as opposed to writing. And, you know, this is starting to find its way into email as well. And now, you know, even email is becoming outmoded, and it's all about texting and tweeting. And, you know, more and more my fear is, at risk of sounding once again like an old fogey, that, you know, these kids who are coming up today, you know, they're not learning how to write. They're only learning how to text and to tweet. And they're not actually learning the English language, okay? And what this ultimately means is that there's sort of this reign of sloppiness, right? Everything is shorthand. Everything is, you know, these cute little interjected acronym phrases like BTW for by the way. And we're just, you know, sort of stringing these little prefab phrases along, and we're not actually paying attention to what we're saying, but increasingly going on automatic. So, this is the second, of the tendencies which I'm describing. A few points which I could elaborate on here. A way that this is not isolated merely to texting, but it's insidiously finding its way even into journalism. Okay, for instance, nobody uses quotation marks correctly anymore. Have you noticed that? Now, when I was growing up, I learned that. Now, here's Weinberg ranting about quotation marks on WBAI, but it's important, and I'm going to explain why it's important. When I was growing up, I learned that when you are quoting within a quote, when you are actually quoting somebody else within a quote that you're using, you know, the quote within a quote is in single quotes. And, you know, the main quote is in the normal double quotes, and then the quote within the quote is in single quotes. Almost nobody does that anymore because now, you know, when you are quoting a piece of text and putting it in quotes, you're copying it and pasting it. And of course, the source that you're copying it from is the primary source. So the part which is in quotes is in double quotes. And then you just paste it into your document and put double quotes around the whole thing. So you've got double quotes within double quotes as opposed to single quotes within double quotes. And people do not actually, you know, take the time, as I always do, by the way, but many people do not take the time to go and change the double quotes from what you just cut and paste into single quotes. So the whole notion of using, you know, single quotes for a quote within a quote is rapidly disappearing from the English language. All right? It's going fast. It's practically gone. Even in mainstream journalism, I'm beginning to see, you know, this dumb error being made where people will just, you know, slap down the cut and paste text without bothering to clean up the quotation marks. So what does this mean? This means, okay, this is not just, you know, me being an old-fashioned fuddy-duddy. I insist that it's not, okay? This actually means that the clarity and utility of the English language is eroding. And this has got serious political implications, as we will go on to discuss if time permits. Brackets. Practically nobody uses brackets anymore. Brackets are important, again, in terms of quoted material, because if you're going to use parentheses to make an editorial interjection in quoted material, then it's unclear whether the parentheses were in the original or not, which is why, technically, you're supposed to use brackets for editorial interjections in quoted material, so people will know that it's an editorial interjection. Well, even in wire copy, even the AP is not using brackets anymore because they assume that readers are too dumb to know what brackets are. So they put it in parentheses, which is completely making the material that you're reading less clear because the parentheses could have actually been in the original text. People use parentheses, right? Particularly if you're quoting from something which is written as opposed to an oral quote, people use parentheses. So now, you know, the language has become more vague and less specific and exacting. Okay. Now, in terms of this is getting a little bit further afield here. It's getting a little bit further afield. But even in spoken English, I'm noting some especially when I speak to younger folks, I'm noting some disturbing tendencies which are beginning to emerge. For instance, have you noticed, did you ask anybody a yes or no question these days, and invariably the response is, yeah, no. They say both. Which do they mean? Invariably, particularly somebody under 30, you ask them any yes or no question, and the response is, yeah, no. Which do they mean? Now, if they go on to actually, you know, clarify, then it should become clear from context which they mean. But first of all, it's one more. If you simply said yeah or no, there would be no ambiguity, and it would be less syllables, more concise, right? But instead, everybody says yeah, no. Now, how did this get started? Well, I think probably it got started with, if you actually mean to say, if your real answer is actually no, then the first yeah is sarcastic, right? As in, yeah, no, right? So the first yeah is sarcastic, and then the real answer is no, as if you're dismissing the possibility of yeah. Or if you really mean to say yes, then the yeah is the real answer, and then the no is like dismissing any possibility that that the question has been misunderstood, I suppose. But you know, it's to me, it's something which people just sort of unconsciously do, and I find it irritating, okay, because it's making the language less clear and less exacting. Another such example, have you ever noticed, this is just an example of how people, you know, talk without thinking, and how phrases just become sort of reified and take on a life of their own and become divorced from meaning. Have you ever noticed that 10 years ago or 15 years ago, if people wanted to say, the thing is, the English language is deteriorating, they would just say it like that. The thing is, the English language is deteriorating. But today, the phrase, the thing is, has become reified. It's become thingified. It's become objectified. And it has actually become divorced from meaning. So people tend to add a second is. So now instead of saying, the thing is, the English language is deteriorating, they say, the thing is, the English language is deteriorating. Because that first is has lost its meaning. It's become reified. So, you can see where this is going, right? I mean, you can already you can hear people actually starting to add the third is, because now the second is becoming a part of the reified phrase. So people are already beginning to say, the thing is the English language is deteriorating. Already you can see that happening. So we can presume that, you know, 20 years down the line, people are going to be saying, the thing is the English language is deteriorating. And then, you know, maybe 30 years down the line or 25 years down the line, people are going to be saying, the thing is the English language is deteriorating. And then, you know, 35 years down the line, people are going to be saying, the thing is the English language is deteriorating, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, right? So why don't people just stop and think about what they're saying? Now, you know, to a certain extent, you shouldn't get too worked up about some of these things, all right? And I'm not saying that, you know, that the older form is always the better form. And there's certain ways that, you know, the language just changes and you've got to accept it. For instance, you know, use of the word whom as opposed to who. You know, I mean, technically, whenever it's describing the object, you're supposed to use whom according to the textbooks. But in reality, nobody uses whom in spoken speech anymore. And even in written English, whom is really only used, except in the most formalistic academic writing, when it follows a preposition. So I don't. That's fine. You're not losing any clarity by dropping the whom. It's just become. It's just a natural evolution of the language. So you know, that's an example of you know, okay, I can live with it. You know, and to a certain extent, you've got to understand that language is a, you know, a flowing, organic thing, and it evolves, and accept that. I mean, nobody thinks of you know, gay as meaning happy anymore. Okay, and that's. You know, it still has that connotation because, you know, gays didn't like some of the other things which they were being called, and they wanted to, you know, choose a word which has got positive connotations. So, fine. Okay. No problem. Another such example where, you know, maybe I should just get used to the fact that the word that the word has changed its meaning, or the phrase has changed its meaning, is hook up. Now, this used to be a really innocent phrase, right? If you wanted to, like, you know, meet somebody for lunch and you weren't quite sure what time you were going to be free, you would say, well, you know, give me a call and we'll hook up sometime in the afternoon. Well, you can't say that anymore, especially not if you're talking to somebody who's under 20, I mean under 30, because it's got a whole different meaning today with the under 30 crowd, right? You say, give me a call and we'll hook up tomorrow. You better have established a certain degree of intimacy with the person you're speaking with first, or you're going to be getting a dirty look, right? So now, you know, to me, this is something because, like, you know, I'm an old school kind of guy. You know, I'm well past 45, okay? So for me, hookup has still got completely innocent connotations, just like, you know, gay did for our parents' generation, right? But, you know, at a certain point, you just got to accept that hookup means something different for these kids today. And it's not necessarily a bad thing. It's just the way it is. But there are certain other ones which I'm sorry, but I am going to resist to my dying breath. For instance, the abuse of the word literally. Oh, man, does it get on my nerves. People today, you know, just use the word literally just to add emphasis without any respect for its actual meaning. And here, it's not merely that, you know, the meaning is changing, as in the case of hookup, but that the meaning is being lost and that the word is becoming less useful, less exacting, less precise, more vague. So literally has just become a way of adding emphasis. It no longer, you know, means literally in contradistinction to figuratively. When people say, you know, we have to literally let sleeping dogs lie. Well, unless you're actually talking about a real flesh and blood dog that you don't want to wake up, you don't mean literally let sleeping dogs lie. You know, I heard a commentator say on NPR recently, National Public Radio, that with a particular controversial issue, the president is literally walking with a hand grenade in his pocket. What are you talking about? The president does not have any hand grenade in his pocket. You could say he's figuratively talking with a walking with a hand grenade in his pocket, metaphorically walking with a hand grenade in his pocket, but not literally walking with a hand grenade in his pocket, unless he's literally walking with a hand grenade in his pocket, which is very, very unlikely. So I'm going to resist this one to my dying breath. I'm sorry. Okay. That one I'm not going to accept. This one, you know, Weinberg is going down fighting in defense of the word literally. Okay. I am literally going to go down fighting. Well, no, actually, no. I'm going to figuratively go down fighting in defense of the word literally. Okay. So, all right. That's point number two. Okay. The general decline of exactitude, which is related to the ascendancy of texting and the decline of writing, which is actually, I would submit, starting to creep into spoken English as well as written English. Point number three. Point number three is akin to what Lena Horne was singing about at the top of the show, which is corporate colonization of the English language and the words being appropriated by Madison Avenue to sell us products, and the language of corporate commerce starting to, you know, colonize everyday speech and everyday writing. Now, this is sort of the postmodernist influence of propaganda on human language, you could argue. So this, you know, I think of when, I mean, obviously in place names, this isn't anything so new, but like, you know, I mean, I don't know if it's necessarily all that worse for the Mets to be playing in Citi Field than Shea Stadium, but at least, you know, Shea was just like, you know, some guy, as opposed to, you know, Citibank being, you know, this big evil corporation. And a lot of people think, tongue-in-cheek, that it should actually be named Taxpayer Field in reference to the recent bailout. Another example of what I'm talking about, and this, this again, I'm even starting to alarmingly hear this from journalists. In regard to sources, you know, you ask somebody, well, how do you know that? What's your source? And what's the answer? Google it. Well, Google's the name of a corporation. Okay. So, I mean, for starters, you know, it's like, it's akin to saying Xerox something as opposed to photocopy something. That's not so bad. But, what's worse is that, you know, I mean, Google it is not a source. There's all sorts of garbage on the internet, right? Google it is not a source. And if I'm asking you for a source, if I'm asking you for how you actually know a particular bit of information which you are imparting as the truth, you know, it's incumbent upon you to actually provide the source that you found on Google rather than just saying Google it, all right? As opposed to, you know, the whole sinister notion of using the name of a corporation as a verb in everyday speech, as opposed to look for it on the internet. But you see, once again, if you were going to say look for it on the internet, then, you know, that leads itself to the immediate question of, well, where should I look for it? What website should I go to? As opposed to, you know, Google it just makes it sound like, oh, you know, you just, it's all magic. You know, you're just putting it to Google and voila, all the facts just magically appear. And what, fact-checking? Rigor? Checking out your sources? All that old-fashioned stuff the journalist used to do? No, don't worry about that. Just Google it. Let's see. What's another example of what I'm talking about here? Oh, yeah, right. Have you ever noticed these days when you call 311, they tell you, thank you for calling New York City. As if, you know, as if we were customers calling, you know, a department store, as if we were calling Macy's or calling calling any, you know, calling any other private business where we had, you know, where we could shop around. Thank you for calling New York City. Well, look, I'm a citizen. What city do you expect me to call? I mean, it's like, you know, if I want to report a code violation in my building, what should I do? Call Los Angeles? Call Chicago? I'm in New York. What do you mean, thank you for calling New York City? You know, how about thank you for your call? We'll be on it right away. That would be a little bit more appropriate, as opposed to, like, you know, oh, we're just, you know, in business. And if you don't like it, you can just, you know, you can just take your business elsewhere. Okay. Similarly, have you noticed that all of the messages to the public on the subways now, the MTA refers to the riders as customers. Okay. Once again, the same kind of, you know, corporate lingo here. So, the implication is, you know, once again, that, you know, this is not a public service to which we are entitled as citizens, but it's a private service which we can take or leave as consumers. Okay, it's a very critical distinction here. And, you know, it's a very insidious way that, you know, this corporate lingo is slipping into the language of the public sector, a customer. Okay, a customer? Well, I suppose, yeah, we are giving them, you know, their money, our money, in return for a service. But, you know, it's not like we have much of a choice, right? It's not like, you know, if we're not happy with the MTA, well, we can just, you know, shop around and, okay, maybe I'll try the Chicago subway system instead of the New York subway system. You know, I mean, maybe I'll try the Paris subway system. Maybe I'll try the Paris Metro if I don't like the New York subway system. No, I'm sorry. This is not about, you know, being a boutiqueified connoisseur of mass transit. It's about getting to work in the morning, okay? Right? I'm sorry, the Paris Metro doesn't go to Queens, okay? I'm trying to get to work in the morning. Hello? So, I object to being called a customer when I'm on the subway, okay? You want to call me a passenger, a rider, or a citizen? That's fine. But please don't call me a customer as if, you know, I was just, you know, a consumer taking a pleasure ride, okay? That's not what mass transit is supposed to be about. All right, so if corporate colonization of the English language is the postmodernist propagandistic abuse, which is leading to the ultimately to the degradation of the English language, unfortunately, the old modernist such abuse of plain old government propaganda, public sector propaganda, if you will, it continues to exist. It isn't like it's gone away. It continues to exist alongside the postmodernist variety. And this has to do, you know, with the reign of political euphemism, which has actually become practically universal. I have to call out Barack Obama on something in this regard, which is now. George Bush used the phrase global war on terrorism, which, you know, is a bellicose rallying cry. But what Obama has replaced it with is possibly even worse because it's more insidious and it's a euphemism. Now, instead of the global war on terrorism, you know, cue the trumpets, now it's the very clean, dry, and antiseptic overseas contingency operations. But George Bush was really the really has a lot to answer for in this department as well, despite the fact that, you know, global war on terrorism is perhaps a more honest phrase than overseas contingency operations. Propaganda device which has been recognized by George Orwell in his work Politics and the English Language, which perhaps if we have time we'll do a little reading from later, is meaningless words, where the speaker or the writer uses a word, but he has his own private definition of what the word means, which he doesn't let the reader or the listener onto. So, you know, George Bush can say with a straight face, you know, that this government does not engage in torture because, well, according to, you know, his legal counsel, torture has been dumbed down to, you know, it's been completely redefined to mean pain equivalent to organ failure or death, quote unquote. So he goes on TV and says this government doesn't torture, and he thinks he's, you know, he can get away with saying this with a straight face. And it's not a lie because he's got his own private definition of what torture means. But in fact, he's engaging in a in what Orwell called a meaningless word. And similarly, we've got you know, the whole notion of supporting the troops. Supporting the troops has become clearly it's become nothing other than a euphemism for supporting the war. All right. So the people who want to keep the troops in harm's way, getting shot at in Iraq and Afghanistan, are supporting the troops, even though they aren't providing them with sufficient body armor, even though they're slashing veterans' benefits,
they're the ones who are, you know, putting them in harm's way out in the desert, and then they come back and they don't even, you know, they can't even get decent treatment at a VA hospital, but they're supporting the troops. Whereas those of us who, want to bring the troops home and out of harm's way, where they're not going to be getting shot at in the desert, we are accused of not supporting the troops. So this is all pretty obvious, right? Some more insidious ones in the same line, vis-a-vis the coup d'état in Honduras. A lot of the media reportage has referred to Roberto Michelete as the interim president of Honduras, as if he had been brought to power through some kind of legal means, which he is not. He's not the interim president of Honduras. He is the de facto president of Honduras, an important distinction. Alvaro Uribe, the president of Colombia, who, you know, is the worst human rights abuser in the Western Hemisphere by far, and is engaging in, you know, programs of terrorizing peasants and indigenous peoples and forcing them from their lands and so on, calls his political policy one of democratic security. All right, now this is obvious, right? This is very, very obvious. And this is the one which, in fact, Orwell addressed very, very directly in his 1946 essay, Politics in the English Language, which perhaps we'll see if we have time to read a little bit of. But this is not something which is merely confined to the propaganda of the ruling elites, unfortunately. But it's also, you see the same kinds of tendencies, unfortunately, creeping into journalism across the spectrum and commentary across the spectrum, including the left. Another mechanism of propaganda, which Orwell identifies in this essay, is the verbal false limb, which is something which is thrown in, one of these prefabricated phrases which is thrown in merely to give what you're saying an air of importance, or to give a sense of substance to something which would otherwise fall flat because it hasn't really got much of a... it hasn't actually got much behind it in the way of fact or argument. One which I hear all the time, especially from callers to WBAI, I have to say, is the fact of the matter is. Now, it's a sure sign if somebody who has to lard every sentence out of his mouth with the fact of the matter is, it's a sure sign that he really doesn't know what the hell he's talking about, and he hasn't really got much of a case. If he really had a case, he would let the facts speak for themselves without having to, impress upon you that the fact of the matter is. And it's especially clear that he or she isn't even paying attention to what he or she is saying, when in fact they don't give you a fact following that phrase, but give you something which is completely subjective and is completely an opinion. For instance, the fact of the matter is that... The ongoing violence in the Middle East is all the fault of the Palestinians, right? I mean, that the kind of thing that you actually hear. Obviously, you know, this is not a fact. This is an opinion, and people will, you know, merely lard their opinion with this, you know, a prefabricated phrase. The fact of the matter is, to give it the appearance of being a fact. But, you know, you shouldn't fall for that. Obviously, it's not a fact. It's an opinion, right? And this is what I mean by bad polemicism, okay? If you're ever reading anything where the writer is thrown in, the fact of the matter is, this means that the writer really hasn't got much of a case and that the editor didn't do his or her job by taking out such meaningless phrases. So... let's see. You know, I recently had the opportunity to take a look at a little bit of Chris Hedge's new book, Empire of Illusion, The End of Literacy and the Triumph of Spectacle, which has got a very intriguing title. And I have to say that I was rather disappointed in it. I didn't read the whole thing cover to cover, but from what I read, I didn't see anything in it about the end of literacy. Or about the triumph of spectacle. there was a long chapter which was extremely lurid, bashing pornography in the most moralistic terms, worthy of a Jerry Falwell or an Andrea Dworkin. But I didn't see much in it about the end of literacy. I'm afraid I don't have too much good to say about it. But personally, I like the classics. I'm going to, if time remains, read a little bit of George Orwell, Politics in the English Language. Before I do, I'm going to, which I think cuts to the chase in terms of the issues that I'm ranting about tonight, and ought to be required reading for, certainly for anybody who's involved in the trade of journalism, such as it continues to exist, which is just barely, and really anybody who is concerned with political issues at all. This essay really ought to be required reading. And it's a short essay. It doesn't take very long. See if I can get through any of it. Predictably, I ranted on longer than I thought that I would. I do have a few words to say about the crisis here at WBAI by way of introduction, because certainly the conflict which continues to tear WBAI apart is unfortunately rapidly becoming a case study in abuse of the English language. You know, increasingly I view Bernard White in a light similar to that of Hugo Chavez. As much as I would like to root for Hugo Chavez, invariably he does something that, you know, I just can't quite go along with. And in his, on a theme somewhat related to what we're talking about tonight, his most recent move of against the media in Venezuela. Now, I understand the logic that, freedom of the press belongs to one who owns one, and that, the means of communication ought to be subject to democratization and redistribution, just like the means of production and land. Nonetheless, shutting down 200 radio stations strikes me as going overboard just a tad, 200 radio stations, that might be just a bit excessive. In addition, he's promulgating this law which shut down any media which violate norms of new, rather draconian norms of national security. I mean, if the government was doing anything to rein in the press in this country along those lines, we'd all be up in arms about it, quite rightly. And, you can argue that here it would be in the interest of the elites and capitalism, whereas in Venezuela it's in the interests of popular program and socialism. Yeah, you can make that argument, and there's some merit to that argument, but still, I don't quite know if I can go along with this. Bernard, if you're listening tonight, I went to bat for you during the Christmas coup, but you're really kind of blowing it this time around. That speech, we're going to get you. I understand that that could be interpreted to mean, that we're going to unseat you. We're going to turn the tables on you politically, which is what he said speaking at the Pacifica National Board meeting here in New York City a couple of weeks ago. But obviously the implications of the phrase going to get you are bellicose, and if you didn't actually mean to imply a physical threat, why did you use that phrase? Especially given how fraught the atmosphere at Pacifica is generally, and the fact that, there have been accusations of both threats of physical violence and of actual physical violence around WBAI. Why use that kind of language? I mean, you're just shooting yourself in the foot. You really are. This whole ethic of shouting down the other side, which both sides have engaged in, Bernard's side has engaged in it in a much more aggressive and organized fashion, has to be said. One could argue that, that's because they're the ones who are out of power, so they have more incentive to do so. But nonetheless, it remains the case. And I can't go along with those kind of tactics. Once again, as I've said before, if they feel that the democratic process was abrogated to the point where those kind of tactics are justified, and that nothing which the board, either the local board or the national board, does is legitimate, and that the only alternative is to gum up the works, well, you know, you really better make a case for that kind of thing. And they haven't made a clear case. They really haven't. I mean, I've been following the whole thing, and I haven't heard them make a really forthright case. And I'll say that even during the Christmas coup, when the lines and the issues were much, much more clearly drawn, not the lines, but the issues, were much more clearly drawn than they are now, nobody used that kind of rhetoric of "we're going to get you." Can't go along with this, guys. Really can't. On the other side of the coin, I have to say that certain signs which the new signals which the new management has given of their direction here at BAI don't entirely sit well with me. I must dissent somewhat from the decision during the most recent fund drive to air reruns of health programming at night. I appreciate the fact that they made an exception for my slot where I had the interview lined up. I do appreciate that. But, you know, to air, well, it seems like it was five nights a week, reruns of health programming, it sort of plays into the charge which has been made that, you know, BAI is just kind of going soft and squishy and new age and is losing its political edge under the new regime. So management, the new management ought to think about that a little bit more carefully. I also note that at least for the duration of the fund drive, Informativo, the Spanish edition of the news, has not been aired. And don't get me wrong, I am a big fan of Free Speech Radio News, and I get a lot out of both Informativo and Free Speech Radio News. And I thought it was a good arrangement to have FSRN on at 6:30 and Informativo on at 11:30, so we could get to hear both. Because Informativo, all right, you know, I mean, I'm not without criticism of them either. They're certainly much more enthusiastic for Hugo Chavez than I am. But they do a lot of really good reportage about Latin America, which I'm not getting elsewhere on the radio dial. And I hope that once the fund drive is over, Informativo will be back on the air. And, okay, having spoken in defense of the English language tonight, I'd like to say a few words in defense of the Spanish language. Español es el idioma del futuro en este continente y uno de los idiomas del futuro en esta ciudad. Y por eso yo apoyo más programación en castellano aquí en emisora WBAI. Y gracias por la oportunidad de decir esto. Okay. With that, you know, I guess, you know, I'm prepared to, I was a dissident under Bernard's management, and I guess I'm prepared to continue going on being a dissident under the new management as well. And I guess that's just my role in life is to be the eternal dissident. In fact, I'm considering starting an anarchist line of toothpaste called Dissident. Okay. Enough levity. Let's see if, in fact, we do have time to read some George Orwell. George Orwell, Politics and the English Language, 1946. Most people who bother with the matter at all would admit that the English language is in a bad way, but it is generally assumed that we cannot, by conscious action, do anything about it. Our civilization is decadent, and our language, so the argument runs, must inevitably share in the general collapse. It follows that any struggle against the abuse of language is a sentimental archaism, like preferring candles to electric light, or horse-drawn carriages to airplanes. Underneath this lies the half-conscious belief that language is a natural growth and not an instrument which we shape for our own purposes. Now, it is clear that the decline of language must ultimately have political and economic causes. It is not due simply to the bad influence of this or that individual writer, but an effect can become a cause, reinforcing the original cause, and producing the same effect in an intensified form, and so on indefinitely. A man may take the drink because he feels himself to be a failure, and then fail all the more completely because he drinks. It is rather the same thing that is happening to the English language. It becomes ugly and inaccurate because our thoughts are foolish, but the slovenliness of our language makes it easier for us to have foolish thoughts. The point is that the process is reversible. Modern English, especially written English, is full of bad habits which spread by imitation and which can be avoided if one is willing to take the necessary trouble. If one gets rid of these habits, one can think more clearly, and to think clearly is a necessary first step towards political regeneration. So that the fight against bad English is not frivolous and is not the exclusive concern of professional writers. This mixture of vagueness and sheer incompetence is the most marked characteristic of modern English prose, and especially of any kind of political writing. As soon as certain topics are raised, the concrete melts into the abstract, and no one seems able to think of turns of speech that are not hackneyed. Prose consists less and less of words chosen for the sake of their meaning, and more of phrases tacked together like sections of a prefabricated henhouse. I list below, with notes and examples, various of the tricks by means of which the work of prose construction is habitually dodged. Dying metaphors. A newly invented metaphor assists thought by evoking a visual image, while on the other hand, the metaphor which is technically dead, for instance, iron resolution, has in effect reverted to being an ordinary word and can generally be used without loss of vividness. But in between these two classes, there is a huge dump of worn-out metaphors, which have lost all evocative power and are merely used because they save people the trouble of inventing phrases for themselves. Examples are, take up the cudgel for, ring the changes in, toe the line, ride roughshod over, stand shoulder to shoulder with, play into the hands of, no axe to grind, grist to the mill, fishing in troubled waters, on the order of the day, Achilles' heel, swan song, hotbed. Many of these are used without knowledge of their meaning, and incompatible metaphors are frequently mixed, a sure sign that the writer is not interested in what he is saying. Some metaphors now current have been twisted out of their original meaning without those who use them even being aware of the fact. For example, toe the line, T-O-E, is sometimes written as toe the line, T-O-W. Another example is the hammer and the anvil, now always used with the implication that the anvil gets the worst of it. In real life, it is always the anvil that breaks the hammer, never the other way around. A writer who stopped to think about what he was saying would be aware of this and would avoid perverting the original phrase. Operators, or verbal false limbs. These save the trouble of picking out appropriate verbs and nouns, and at the same time pad each sentence with extra syllables, which give it an appearance of symmetry. Characteristic phrases are render inoperative, militate against, make contact with, be subjected to, give rise to, give grounds for, have the effect of, play a leading role in, make itself felt, take effect, exhibit a tendency to, serve the purpose of, etc., etc. The keynote is the elimination of simple verbs. Instead of being a single word, such as break, stop, spoil, mend, kill, a verb becomes a phrase, made up of a noun or adjective tacked on to some general purpose verb, such as prove, serve, form, play, render. In addition, the passive voice is whenever possible used in preference to the active, and noun constructions are used instead of gerunds, by examination of, instead of by examining. Some simple conjunctions and prepositions are replaced by phrases such as with respect to, having regard to, the fact that, by dint of, in view of, in interest of, on the hypothesis that, and the ends of sentences are saved from anticlimax. by such resounding commonplaces as greatly to be desired cannot be left out of account, a development to be expected in the near future, deserving of serious consideration, brought to a satisfactory conclusion, and so on and so forth. Pretentious diction. Words like phenomenon, elemental, individual as a noun, objective, categorical, effective, virtual, basic, primary, promote, constitute, exhibit, exploit, utilize, eliminate, liquidate, are used to dress up simple statements and give an air of scientific impartiality to biased judgments. Adjectives like epoch-making, epic, historic, unforgettable, triumphant, age-old, inevitable, inexorable, veritable, are used to dignify the sordid process of international politics, while writing that aims at glorifying war usually takes on an archaic color, its characteristic words being realm, throne, chariot, mailed fist, trident, sword, shield, buckler, banner, jackboot, clarion. Foreign words and expressions such as cul-de-sac, ancien regime, deus ex machina, mutus mutandi, status quo, weltschwang are used to give an air of culture and elegance. Except for the useful abbreviations, i.e., e.g., etc., there is no need for any of the hundreds of foreign phrases now current in English. Bad writers, and especially scientific, political, and sociological writers, are nearly always haunted by the notion that Latin or Greek words are grander than Saxon ones, and unnecessary words like expedite, ameliorate, extraneous, deracinated, subaqueous, and hundreds of others gain ground from their Anglo-Saxon opposite numbers. The jargon peculiar to Marxist writing, hyena, hangman, cannibal, petty bourgeois, these gentry, lackey, flunky, mad dog, white guard, etc., consists largely of phrases translated from Russian, German, or French. The result in general is an increase in slovenliness and vagueness. Meaningless words. In certain kinds of writing, particularly in art criticism and literary criticism, it is normal to come across long passages which are almost completely lacking in meaning. Words like romantic, plastic, human, dead, sentimental, natural, vitality, as used in art criticism, are strictly meaningless, in the sense that they not only do not point to any discoverable object, but are hardly ever expected to do so by the reader. When one critic writes, "The outstanding feature of Mr. X's work is its living quality," while another writes, "The immediately striking thing about Mr. X's work is its peculiar deadness," the reader accepts that this is a simple difference in opinion. If words like black and white were involved instead of the jargon words dead and living, he would at once see that language was being used in an improper way. Many political words are similarly abused. The word fascism has now no meaning except insofar as it signifies something not desirable. The words democracy, socialism, freedom, patriotic, realistic, justice, have each of them several different meanings which cannot be reconciled with one another. In the case of a word like democracy, not only is there no agreed definition, but the attempt to make one is resisted from all sides. It is almost universally felt that when we call a country democratic, we are praising it. Consequently, the defenders of every kind of regime claim it as a democracy, and fear that they might have to stop using the word if it were tied down to any one meaning. Words of this kind are often used in a consciously dishonest way. That is, the person that uses them has his own private definition, but allows his hearer to think he means something quite different. Statements like, "Marshal Petain was a true patriot. The Soviet press is the freest in the world. The Catholic Church is opposed to persecution," are almost always made with the intent to deceive. Other words which used in variable meanings, in most cases more or less dishonestly, are class, totalitarian, science, progressive, reactionary, bourgeois, equality. Now that I have made this catalog of swindles and perversions, let me give another example of the kind of writing that they lead to. This time, it must be of its nature an imaginary one. I am going to translate a passage of good English into modern English of the worst sort. Here is a well-known verse from Ecclesiastes. "I returned and saw under the sun that the race is not to the swift, nor the battle to the strong, neither yet bread to the wise, nor riches to men of understanding, nor yet favor to men of skill, but time and chance happeneth to them all." Here it is in modern English. Objective considerations of contemporary phenomena compel the conclusion that success or failure in competitive activities exhibits no tendency to be commensurate with innate capacity, but that a considerable element of the unpredictable must invariably be taken into account. The beginning of the beginning and ending of the sentence follow the original meaning fairly closely, but in the middle, the concrete illustrations, race, battle, bread, dissolve into the vague phrase, success or failure in competitive activities. This had to be so, because no modern writer of the kind I am discussing, no one capable of using phrases like objective consideration of contemporary phenomena, would ever tabulate his thoughts in that precise and detailed way. The whole tendency of modern prose is away from concreteness. Now analyze the two sentences a little more closely. The first contains 49 words, but only 60 syllables. And all its words are those of everyday life. The second contains 38 words and 90 syllables. 18 of its words are from Latin roots and one from the Greek. The first sentence consists of 6 vivid images and only one phrase, time and chance, that could be called vague. The second contains not a single fresh, arresting phrase, and in spite of its 90 syllables, it gives only a shortened version of the meaning contained in the first. Yet without a doubt, it is the second kind of sentence that is gaining ground in modern English. I do not want to exaggerate. This kind of writing is not yet universal, and outcrops of simplicity will occur here and there in the worst written page. Still, if you or I were told to write a few lines on the uncertainty of human fortunes, we should probably come much nearer to my imaginary sentence than to the one from Ecclesiastes. As I have tried to show, modern writing at its worst does not consist in picking out words for the sake of their meaning and inventing images in order to make the meaning clearer. It consists of gumming together long strips of words which have already been set in order by someone else and making the results presentable by sheer humbug. The attraction of this way of writing is that it is easy. It is easier, even quicker once you have the habit, to say, in my opinion, it is not an unjustifiable assumption that, than to say, I think. If you use ready-made phrases, you not only do not have to hunt about for words, you also don't have to bother about the rhythms of your sentence, since these phrases are generally so arranged as to be more or less euphonious. When you are composing in a hurry, when you are dictating to a stenographer, for instance, or making a speech in public, it is natural to fall into a pretentious Latinized style. Tags like, a consideration which we should do well to bear in mind, or a conclusion to which all of us would readily assent, will save many a sentence from coming down with a bump. By using stale metaphors, similes, and idioms, you save much mental effort at the cost of leaving your meaning vague, not only for your reader, but for yourself. This is the significance of mixed metaphors. The sole aim of a metaphor is to call up a visual image. When these images clash, as in, the fascist octopus has sung its swan song, or the jackboot is thrown into the melting pot, it can be taken as certain that the writer is not seeing a mental image of the objects he is naming. In other words, he is not really thinking. People who write in this manner usually have a general emotional meaning. They dislike one thing and want to express solidarity with another, but they are not interested in the detail of what they are saying. A scrupulous writer, in every sentence he writes, will ask himself at least 4 questions. What am I trying to say? What words will express it? What image or idiom will make it clearer? Is this image fresh enough to have an effect? And he will probably ask himself 2 more. Could I have put it more shortly? Have I said anything that is unavoidably ugly? But you are not obliged to go to all this trouble. You can shirk it by simply throwing your mind open and letting the ready-made phrases come crowding in. They will construct your sentences for you, even think your thoughts for you to a certain extent. And if need, they will perform the important service of partially concealing your meaning even from yourself. It is at this point that the special connection between politics and the debasement of language becomes clear. In our time, it is broadly true that political writing is bad writing. Where it is not true, it will generally be found that the writer is some kind of rebel, expressing his own private opinions and not a party line. Orthodoxy, of whatever color, seems to demand a lifeless, imitative style. The political dialects to be found in pamphlets, leading articles, manifestos, white papers, and the speeches of undersecretaries do, of course, vary from party to party, but they are all alike in that one almost never finds in them a fresh, vivid, homemade turn of speech. When one watches some tired hack on the platform mechanically repeating the same familiar phrases, bestial atrocities, iron heel, bloodstained tyranny, free peoples of the world, stand shoulder to shoulder, one has the curious feeling that one is not watching a live human being, but some kind of dummy, a feeling which suddenly becomes stronger at moments when the light catches the speaker's spectacles and turns them into blank discs, which seem to have no eyes behind them. And this is not altogether fanciful. A speaker who uses this kind of phraseology has gone some distance towards turning himself into a machine. The appropriate noises are coming out of his larynx, but his brain is not involved as it would be if he were choosing his words for himself. If the speech he is making is one that he is accustomed to make over and over again, he may be almost unconscious of what he is saying, as when one utters the responses in church. And this is in this reduced state of consciousness, and this reduced state of consciousness, if not indispensable, is at any rate favorable to political conformity. In our time, political speech and writing are largely the defense of the indefensible. Things like the continuance of British rule in India, the Russian purges and deportations, the dropping of the atomic bombs on Japan, can indeed be defended, but only by arguments which are too brutal for most people to face, and which do not square with the professed aims of political parties. Thus, political language has to consist largely of euphemism, question-begging, and sheer cloudy vagueness. Defenseless villages are bombarded from the air, the inhabitants driven out into the countryside, the cattle machine-gunned, the huts set on fire with incendiary bullets. This is called pacification. Millions of peasants are robbed of their farms, sent trudging along the roads with no more than they can carry. This is called transfer of population or rectification of frontiers. People are imprisoned for years without trial or shot in the back of the neck or sent to die of scurvy in Arctic lumber camps. This is called elimination of unreliable elements. Such phraseology is needed if one wants to name things without calling up mental pictures of them. Consider, for instance, some comfortable English professor defending Russian totalitarianism. He cannot say outright, "I believe in killing off your opponents," when you can get good results by doing so. Probably, therefore, he will say something like this. While freely conceding that the Soviet regime exhibits certain features which the humanitarian may be inclined to deplore, we must, I think, agree that a certain curtailment of the right to political opposition is an unavoidable concomitant of transitional periods, and that the rigors which the Russian people have been called upon to undergo have been amply justified in the sphere of concrete achievement. The inflated style is itself a kind of euphemism. A mass of Latin words falls upon the facts like soft snow, blurring the outlines and covering up the details. The great enemy of clear language is insincerity. When there is a gap between one's real and one's declared aims, one turns, as it were, instinctively to long words and exhausted idioms, like a cuttlefish squirting out ink. In our age, there is no such thing as keeping out the politics. All issues are political issues, and politics itself is a mass of lies, evasions, folly, hatred, and schizophrenia. When the general atmosphere is bad, language must suffer. I should expect to find that, remember, this is 1946 when he's writing, that the German, Russian, and Italian languages have all deteriorated in the last 10 or 15 years as a result of dictatorship. But if thought corrupts language, language can also corrupt thought. A bad usage can spread by tradition and imitation, even among people who should and do know better. The debased language that I have been discussing is in some ways very convenient. Phrases like "a not unjustifiable assumption," "leaves much to be desired," "would serve no good purpose," "a consideration which we should do well to bear in mind," are a continuous temptation. A packet of aspirins always at one's elbow. Look back through this essay, and for certain you will find that I have again and again committed the very faults I am protesting against. I said earlier that the decadence of our language is probably curable. Those who deny this would argue, if they produced any argument at all, that the language merely reflects existing social conditions, and we cannot influence its development by any direct tinkering with words and constructions. So far as the general tone or spirit of a language goes, this may be true. But it is not true in detail. Silly words and expressions have often disappeared, not through any evolutionary process, but by owing to the conscious action of a minority. Two recent examples were explore every avenue and leave no stone unturned. I'm afraid some of these have come back to haunt us in the intervening years, which were killed by the jeers of a few journalists. There is a long list of fly-blown metaphors which we could similarly be got rid of if enough people would interest themselves in the job. It should also be possible to laugh the not-on formation out of existence. One can cure oneself of the not-on formation by memorizing this sentence. A not-on black dog was chasing a not-on small rabbit across a not-on green field. To reduce the amount of Latin and Greek in the average sentence, to drive out foreign phrases and strayed scientific words, and in general, to make pretentiousness unfashionable. But all these are minor points. The defense of the English language implies more than this, and perhaps it is best to start by saying what it does not imply. To begin with, it has nothing to do with archaism, with the salvaging of obsolete words and turns of speech, or with the setting up of a standard English, which must never be departed from. On the contrary, it is especially concerned with the scrapping of every word or idiom which has outworn its usefulness. It has nothing to do with correct grammar and syntax, which are of no importance as long as one makes one meaning clear, or with the avoidance of Americanisms or having what is called a good prose style. On the other hand, it is not concerned with fake simplicity and the attempt to make written English colloquial. Nor does it even imply that in every case one must prefer the Saxon word to the Latin one, though it does imply using the fewest and shortest words that will cover one's meaning. What is above all needed is to let the meaning choose the word, and not the other way around. In prose, the worst thing one can do with words is to surrender to them. When you think of a concrete object, you think wordlessly, and then, if you want to describe the thing you have been visualizing, you probably hunt about till you have found the exact words that seem to fit it. When you think of something abstract, you are more inclined to use the words from the start, and unless you make a conscious effort to prevent it, the existing dialect will come rushing in and do the job for you at the expense of blurring or even changing your meaning. Probably it is better to put off using words as long as possible and get one's meaning as clear as one can through pictures and sensations. Afterward, one can choose, not simply accept, the phrases that will best cover one's meaning, and then switch round and decide what impressions one words are likely to make on another person. This last effort of the mind cuts out all the stale or mixed images, all prefabricated phrases, needless repetitions, and humbug and vagueness generally. By humbug, he means nonsense, BS. One can often be in doubt about the effect of a word or a phrase, and one needs rules that one can rely on when instinct fails. I think the following rules will cover most cases. 1. Never use a metaphor, simile, or other figure of speech that you are used to seeing in print. 2. Never use a long word where a short one will do. 3. If it is possible to cut a word out, always cut it out. 4. Never use the passive when you can use the active. 5. Never use a foreign phrase, a scientific word, or a jargon word if one can think of an everyday English equivalent. And 6. Break any of these rules sooner than say anything outright barbarous. These rules sound elementary, and so they are, but they demand a deep change in the attitude of anyone who has grown used to writing in the style which is now fashionable. I have not here been considering the literary use of language, but merely language as an instrument for expressing, and not for concealing or preventing thought. Some have come near to claiming that all abstract words are meaningless, and have used this as a pretext for advocating a kind of political quietism. Since you don't know what fascism is, how can you struggle against fascism? One need not swallow such absurdities as this, but one ought to recognize that the present political chaos is connected with the decay of language, and that one can probably bring about some improvements by starting at the verbal end. If you simplify your English, you are freed from the worst follies of orthodoxy. You cannot speak any of the necessary dialects, and when you make a stupid remark, its stupidity will be obvious even to yourself. Political language, and with variations, this is true of all political parties, from conservatives to anarchists, is designed to make lies sound truthful and murder respectable, and to give an appearance of solidity to pure wind. One cannot change all of this in a moment, but one can at least change one's own habits. And from time to time, one can even, if one jeers loudly enough, send some worn-out and useless phrase, some jackboot, Achilles heel, hotbed, melting pot, acid test, veritable inferno, or other lump of verbal refuse into the dustbin where it belongs. Right on, George Orwell, Politics in the English Language, 1946, an essay which gives me hope that maybe the process of deterioration of the English language is reversible, although sometimes I have my doubts. George Orwell did not live to see the internet. This has been the Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade on listener-supported non-commercial WBAI 99.5 FM here in New York City. Do stay tuned for, I presume, weaponry with Tom Whisker coming up.
Please remember that this program is supported by the listener members of WBAI New York. If you like what you hear, please consider becoming a member of WBAI or renewing if you've already joined. Basic membership is $25, but we accept any amount. Help us keep free speech alive.